We have two scriptures this morning, one from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament. Hopefully, some of these are somewhat familiar to you. The first from Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, and then verse 6 and 7. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them the light has shined. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with just judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And from the New Testament, the book of Luke, the second chapter, verses 1 through 7. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all of the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, into the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that, while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn.
Wally was big for his age, 7 years old. Everyone wondered what role the teacher would give him in the annual Christmas play, especially considering the fact that Wally was a little bit of a slow learner. Perhaps he could pull the curtain. To everyone's surprise, the teacher gave Wally the role of the innkeeper. The boy, of course, was delighted. After all, he had to learn, all that he had to learn was one line: there is no room in the inn. He had that down in no time. But then came the night for the program. The parents took their places. Every seat in the auditorium was filled. The children entered singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful," and the lights dimmed. A hush moved over the audience. The curtain opened up on scene one. Mary and Joseph entered the stage and walked up to the inn. "Please, sir," said Joseph, "my wife is not well. Could we have a room for the night?" Wally was ready for his line. He had rehearsed it for the past several weeks. He'd rehearsed it all the night before. But he looked out upon the audience, and all he could say was, "There is." And his mind went completely blank. Everyone was embarrassed for him, but poor Wally just didn't know what to do. And the boy playing Joseph thought he would do a little bit of improv, and so he started going over towards the stable at the other side of the room, or other side of the stage. Seeing him walking away, Wally in desperation called out, "Wait, look, there's plenty of room at my house. Come on home with me." What a delightful twist on a familiar story. Over the years, the characters in the Christmas story have become clearly defined for us. And our family tends to read this story every year over and over before we open gifts, usually. We open this story from Luke. The issues all seem so clear-cut. Herod was the villain. The wise men were heroes. Well, they're not in Luke's version. They're actually in Matthew's version. The shepherds, heroes. Angels, heroes. The innkeeper, well, you could maybe say the old innkeeper is maybe a villain. Maybe one of the heavies, you know, in the part. In our mind's eye, we envision him as a crotchety old man, maybe with a nightcap on, you know, and sticking his head out of a second-story window, yelling down, "Take the stable and leave me alone." But perhaps the innkeeper has received some bad press. Preachers over the centuries have had a field day with this poor fellow. But was it his fault that the inn was built with only 12 rooms instead of 13? Was it his fault that Caesar Augustus had issued a decree that the entire world should be taxed? Was it his fault that Mary and Joseph failed to make reservations? You know something? This simple little statement about there being no room in the inn becomes a symbol for Luke. Luke takes this one line, "There is no room in the inn," and shows us how this phrase repeated itself again and again throughout Jesus' ministry. The question that Luke leaves for us is, will there ever be any room for him? It seems there's no room for Jesus in the economic world. Luke records that one day Jesus and the disciples stepped off a boat at Gadara, and a demon-possessed man, screaming wildly and tearing at himself, suddenly approached him, and Jesus walked up to the man and asked his name. "I am legion, for we are many," came the response. He was right. This poor, tormented man was so confused, pulled in so many different directions, that he was no longer one personality, but many. Jesus then commanded the demons to come out of this man and into a nearby herd of swine. The pigs immediately stampeded and ran off a cliff and were killed, and the man was healed. But what was the response of the community? Did they sing praise to God, from whom all blessings flow? Did they cry out, "Praise be to Jesus"? Did they build a hospital in the community and name it after the Nazarene? No, none of these things. What they did was send a committee to Jesus and kindly asked him to get out of town. You see, they weren't so concerned about that poor demonic man. He had been around so many years that he was simply a part of the scenery, part of the landscape. But what really got to them was the fact that Jesus destroyed a herd of swine to heal him. And that was hitting them right where it hurt, in the pocketbook. It was quite clear to them that if Jesus stayed around, the local economy might be disrupted. What they wanted was business as usual and not some itinerant miracle worker. So the local delegation asked Jesus to kind of leave. Exactly how they worded this, the scripture doesn't really say, but I would like to venture a guess, and I suspect the conversation went something like this: "Jesus, our lives were going so well before you came into town. We don't think that we need you. We know that we don't want you. So Jesus, do us a favor and try to go save the world in someplace else. We have to work too hard to fool around with a do-gooder." So there was no room for Jesus in his economic world in which he lived. There was no room for Jesus in the legal realm either. The law was cut and dried. It had been codified centuries earlier, all the way back to Moses. The law was clear, and I don't doubt that some of them said that tired old cliche, "They may not be good rules, but they're all that we have." One of those laws read, "Whosoever commits adultery shall be stoned to death." There it was in black and white. It was even one of the Ten Commandments: "Thou shalt not commit adultery." They came down harder on the enforcement of this law than any other. Well, at least that was on the women. They came down harder on that law, I should say. But so be it. It was the law. The penalty was death by stoning. There were no loopholes, no plea bargaining. So when the crowd brought to Jesus a woman one day that he had clearly been caught in the act, they were ill-prepared for his response. He refused to join their little lynch mob. Didn't he know the Torah? Oh, yes, he knew it, but he also knew something about grace. and that was higher than the law, even the great law of Moses. The crowd was astonished, to say the least, and they dropped their stones and walked away. But you better believe that they didn't like it one bit. A person who had his mind changed against his will is a person whose mind hasn't changed. They didn't do anything about it right away. They were just biding their time. And Jesus had said, in effect, people are more important than rules. They didn't buy that for 1 minute. To them, the law was a law. And it was clear that there was simply no place for Jesus in this whole matter. There was no room for Jesus in the realm of the religious order either. That may sound strange, but it was true. People like Annas and Caiaphas already had high positions that were available. Israel had all the high priests that they needed, and then some. Who was this new man on the scene who called himself teacher and rabbi? Where did he go to seminary? Who were his parents? Where does he get his authority? Nowhere is there any hint that the chief priests were accommodating him. They didn't stretch out their arms and welcome Jesus into their clerical profession. In fact, they did everything they could to keep him out. They weren't about to adjust their comfortable lifestyles and position in community because of the claims of Jesus. But it went far deeper than that. They earnestly thought that he was wrong, and it was their duty to oppose him. They organized themselves, and like politics, religion can also create some strange bedfellows. Their plan climaxed when Jesus was hanging on a cross at Calvary. There was just no room for Jesus in their world. There was no room for Jesus in the world of politics either. Oh, the people wanted him to be king. Some of his disciples became so enthusiastic that they even asked him for positions when he came into his power. But Jesus wouldn't play by the rules. He told them that his kingdom was not of this world. And when he rode into Jerusalem and walked into the temple on Palm Sunday, the crowd was prepared for a coronation ceremony. But Jesus disappointed them once again. He refused to play the game of politics. He shunned the smoke-filled rooms and spent his time with people who did not have their hands on the levers of power. Oh, they gave him a popular mandate, all right. They all agreed that he should be crucified. So his earthly crown was exchanged for a crown of thorns. There was just no room for Jesus in the world of politics. In economic, legal, religious, and political realms, wherever Jesus turned, there was no room for him. What began first in Bethlehem when the innkeeper turned him away was to become a recurrent theme. So what about us today, you and me? Do we have room in our lives for Christ? When the innkeeper was presented with his unexpected situation that night, he faced what I call our universal dilemma. At that point, he became every man or every woman. And every one of us is asked, do you have room for the Messiah? Fact is that the Messiah comes knocking at the door of our hearts many times in life in various ways through various people in various events. So how are we supposed to recognize those times? That's precisely the point. We are given no more preparation for revelation than the innkeeper had that night. He was just an ordinary person like us. He could have said, if I had only known that this was the Messiah, I would have gladly opened the door. But if he had known that, he would have responded out of awe or fear or courtesy, not out of compassion. So the Messiah comes to us just as he came to the Bethlehem innkeeper. Not in the form of a king with his entire splendor, but in the form of people in need like Mary and like Joseph. And whether or not we receive Christ in depends on how we respond to these people. The innkeeper claimed that he had no room. Isn't the crowded inn an appropriate symbol of our lives? So cluttered with inconsequential stuff and things that there's just no time, no energy, no money, no room left over. There's just no room in our lives for the Messiah. And invariably, just as in Bethlehem, the Messiah comes to us when we are so often least expecting him. Mary and Joseph did not make their appearance at the beginning of the rush season, but late in the night, when the poor innkeeper was tired and irritable after a hard day's work. Then comes the knock on the door, the unexpected knock of destiny. So the Advent message to us is to watch and wait in hope, to keep our minds and our hearts open, to keep them open for his coming, and for the hour approaches when the Messiah will come to us. And like the Bethlehem innkeeper, we will be forced to make a decision. Will our lives be so cluttered with incidentals that there will be no room for God? Or will we open the door and gladly welcome him in? To the innkeeper, the knock that came that night was just another of a long series of bothersome interruptions. That is how some of us respond to God in our lives at times. Yes, yes, just take the stable. Do anything. Just leave me alone. God knocks at the door of every person. The question is, will there be room in our lives to let him in? Amen.